Thank you for the introduction. It's not the death of compilers generally, just the death of optimizing compilers. I was told that since this is a tutorial, I should aim at a broad audience. So let me start by making sure that everybody understands the words in my title. So let me see a show of hands. Who knows what an optimizing compiler is? Okay, looks like pretty much everybody. Who knows what death is? Not so many people. That's interesting. I'm happy to see so many people here for the funeral. I wish I could say that optimizing compilers were my best friend, but that's very, very far from the truth. I have three slides. My second slide is this quote from Knuth, which I think most of you have seen before now, and anybody who hasn't seen, well, you've now had time to read it. So let me move on to the third slide, which is the oversimplified story, which says that computers a long, long time ago were very, very slow. I remember when I started programming, which was not that early in the history of computing, early 80s, primarily with an IBM PC, model 5150, that machine ran at 4.77 megahertz. That's not exactly audible frequency, unless you're a bat, maybe, but it's pretty close. It's not a very fast machine. Nowadays, I mean, my laptop is running at multiple gigahertz with multiple cores and doing much more per cycle than the IBM PC did. A reasonable cluster in my office, I have 24 machines. Each of those machines has, depending how you count it, a 4 or 8 core. Well, an AMD FX8350, which is running at 4 gigahertz plus. Those 24 machines have 48 graphics cards, GTX 780s, and those have a lot of computational power. It's maybe a little more expensive for that cluster than the IBM PC was, but not so much more expensive. For the same cost, you end up with so much more computational power now than, say, 30 years ago or 50 years ago, that the concept of what you should be caring about for speed is totally different. And, well, once upon a time, when machines were 4.77 megahertz or even slower, you actually cared about performance. And people would be typically writing software in machine language or assembly language, and then they would try to make it run as quickly as possible, unless it was something that was running only once. But anything that they actually cared about, the performance, which was most software, they would really carefully hand-tune. The situation now is obviously completely different. Right now, CPUs are doing everything you want them to do, basically, instantly. They're that much faster. So you don't have to bother thinking about performance. Most code is written in Python or some other similar kind of scripting language, which is fine. Well, maybe not from a correctness perspective, but just for performance. Programmers are perfectly validly ignoring performance because the machines are just so damn fast. Intel has done all the work that we need for making things run fast. Well, okay, Intel and AMD and NVIDIA and various other chip manufacturers. And the funny thing about this quote from Knuth saying that premature optimization is the root of all evil, that there's, if you over-optimize your code, then there's a serious cost for debugging and maintenance. You might think, well, that's not true if you have an optimizing compiler optimizing your code, but it is true for an optimizing compiler. Because somebody has to write those optimizations. Somebody has to write the compiler and then start modifying it to actually optimize your code automatically. And then maybe some people in this room are such people who are writing those optimizations. And then do those optimizations work? There's at least some people in this room who've written papers that are aiming at trying to verify that an optimization actually works, but that's a tough research problem. It's not a trivial thing to do. And, well, to some extent it's done, but it's not easy. And why are we bothering if we don't care about performance? The debugging, the maintenance, well, okay, maybe that's not the same words as verification and auditing and testing, but these are important concepts for the compiler. There's no reason to put in optimizations into your compiler unless you care about performance. And, well, the oversimplified story ends by saying we no longer care about performance because machines are so fast. So much for optimizing compilers. I have a little time left, so I prepared some backup slides to say that, yeah, the story is maybe not exactly the complete picture. Because as a user, you are very frequently waiting for your computer. Not as often as you would have been many years ago, but you're still frequently saying, hey, where's the result? Come on. I was just looking at the PDF slides on my laptop and flipping to a slide which has a picture, which you'll see in a few moments, and it actually took a moment to display the picture, and that was kind of annoying. I mean, it was okay, it was maybe a 4 megabyte picture in JPEG format for quite a few megapixels, and I shouldn't have maybe done the uncompressed version, so okay, the replacement slides have a compressed version of the picture with a lot less resolution. But okay, this is an example of I was annoyed waiting for my computer. And there's lots more examples of this. And if you're waiting for your computer, then this whole story, the oversimplified story of we don't care about performance, that's obviously not true. So what happens when you're waiting for your computer and you say, hey, I didn't like that, is you often do less computation. For instance, I'll give a video game example. I don't know how many people here are video game people, but there's a lot of users where this is an important way that they're using computers. For those of you who don't take video games seriously, pretend that I'm saying physics simulation. Weather simulation, cancer prediction, whatever. So in your favorite physics simulation, suppose it's a sword fighting simulation. Now, something, if you're watching one of these games, playing one of these games, then you really care about the graphics looking good. And then you're reminded of what actual sword fights look like, which you learn from movies like, say, Kill Bill Volume 1, where I'm assuming that some people here are also familiar with this important piece of literature for this talk. There was this moment in the big fight scene when, okay, the bride, the Uma Thurman character, is holding up the sword, and she's surrounded by bad guys, and you can see her eyes reflected in the sword, and it's obvious that she is using the reflections in the sword to see the bad guys behind her, while she's also, of course, seeing the bad guys in front of her. And if you're a video game developer, then you want to get this right. You want to have the, you know, you can see the reflections off the sword. Now, that's not too hard if you imagine that the sword is something flat, but it's not. It's, first of all, really hard to manufacture a metal that's actually flat. But even if you got that right for the sword in the first place, which I think is not the optimal sword, well, never mind. when the sword hits something, then it starts vibrating, which is why it makes this interesting clanging sound. And if you're a self-respecting video game designer, you want the impact on the sword to go through a realistic physics simulation, realistic enough to get the right kind of sound and the right kind of light reflections. So as the sword is slightly vibrating, that should change what the light is doing. At this point, I actually have some pictures. So this is a picture from the middle of the Thames around the London Bridge a few days ago, where I saw some interesting reflections off the building. And zooming in on that, this is the actual reflection off of something that was manufactured to try to be flat, of a real thing which did not look kind of curvy like that. And well, this is reality. And again, if you're a self-respecting physics simulation engine programmer, then you want to get this sort of thing right. Another example, looking out the other side of the boat, I'm sure somebody can tell me what this pointy building is. It had an interesting reflection on the water. You could see a dark area in the water below it where it was reflecting off of the slight waves on the Thames. But then a few moments later, a boat came by, and it had a wake. And look at what that did to the reflection. Suddenly you can see where the wake was and how the reflection happens. And okay, if you want to do a good physics simulation, you need to do quite a bit of computation to actually have this showing correctly, which some expensive movies do with a lot of computation, but it's still way too much computation, way too slow to put into a video game. And even the movie people don't like spending that much money on that much computation for something where they're still limiting what they're doing, the accuracy of their simulations, because it's such an expensive computation. Okay, another maybe simpler example, which is more day-to-day kind of users interacting with their computers example, is what does it look like when you're displaying a file? Once upon a time, when the CPU is displaying a file, if you did a little profile of where the CPU is spending its time, there's a lot of work in the operating system to start opening the file, finding the file by whatever name to see where the contents are, retrieve the right block, before you can start actually showing anything to the user, and then eventually start showing the file to the user. Maybe you have a VT220 terminal going, and eventually you see the contents of the file, and then there's some cleanup to restore the system back to a state where it can reasonably continue with doing other stuff. And there's a significant amount of time spent in each piece of this computation. It's a fairly flat profile. And then the CPU's got faster, and, well, everything finished faster, and the CPUs got faster and faster and faster and faster, and suddenly the user said, hey, you know, I can stop limiting the sizes of the files I'm willing to look at. Maybe they didn't say this so explicitly. It just naturally happened that users started expanding the data they were working with because the CPUs are faster. And so suddenly the file got bigger. And then, well, the CPUs kept getting faster and faster. And then the users would react again by saying, hey, wait a minute, this is fast enough, I can afford to do something bigger. And it's not that the CPUs are getting faster and therefore the performance of everything is getting so much better that we stop worrying about it. All of these file displays are taking a significant amount of time. Maybe it's moved on from displaying a text file to displaying some picture to displaying some bigger picture, and it keeps going like this, where at some point you stop noticing the time for opening the file and closing the file, cleaning up at the end, and you just notice all the time in the middle. There's this inner loop of displaying file contents, which becomes most of the computation. All right. The natural effect of users having more to do than the CPUs are actually able to do, even today with CPUs being as fast as they are, the natural result of that is that as computation gets cheaper, the users expand the volume of data they're working with. Maybe data sent through the network, maybe data processed inside the computer for those physics simulations or whatever other kinds of computations. Maybe some of you might have had some SMT solvers crashing, and that's a case where you care about how fast your computations are. So what does this mean for the optimizer? Well, you have to look at how those huge volumes of data are handled. The picture now of what the computer is spending its time doing is totally different from the picture before. All we care about is that inner loop that's handling most of the data. If you have gigabytes, terabytes, etc., huge amounts of data being processed, and you have millions of lines of code, there's not going to be a flat profile of how that data is hitting those lines of code. That's an obsolete view of what's happening with profiles of what the optimizer has to care about. So, what do you do with the top operations? Well, you could say displaying a file, that's still a complicated chunk of code, but if you look inside that code, what do you need to optimize? It turns out that there's this kind of fractal structure. Just as the whole display a file operation has various chunks of code which don't take much time because they're not run on all the data or even a significant amount of data, if you look inside the file display, then you find, oh, there's this part and that part and this part which are run only a little bit, and then there's some inner loop which is taking almost all of the time. So there's just a few chunks of code. As our code base increases slowly, as our data increases more and more, as CPUs get faster and faster to enable this getting done, you find that there's less and less of the code where we actually care about performance. Those spots where we care about performance we call hot spots. So these are the little bits of code where your computer is spending most of its time during the times when you're waiting for it, which might be different spots depending on which application you're working with. But those are the parts where we actually care about performance. Because the abstract for this talk didn't fit on the ETAPS webpage, I decided to blog the complete abstract. And this triggered some discussion online over the last few months with some interesting comments, like here's somebody saying, a lot of people have applications whose profiles are mostly flat. And if you look historically, there are lots of examples like this, but they're disappearing. As I said, this view is obsolete. What's happening more and more is that when people take their program where it's spending a lot of time in this inner loop, and then they try optimizing that inner loop, well, if you get amazing optimizations and you're not dealing with that much data, then maybe you end up with a program where there's actually several hotspots, and then, ooh, you'd have to optimize all that to make a significant improvement. But that's more and more rare, because the optimizations, you don't tend to gain more and more and more out of the optimizations the more you look at something. Eventually, the optimizations reach the limit of what anybody can do. Whereas the amount of data and the CPU speed, the amount of data that CPUs are able to handle, that goes up and up and up and up. And so there's more and more focus on small chunks of code, which are what we actually have to optimize. Okay, example of where people care about performance for a very small chunk of code, and there's lots and lots of examples like this. Here's a blog post from Cloudflare. Now, you might not have heard of Cloudflare. This is from February 2015. Cloudflare is a fairly new internet services company. They are running a very large number of websites. There's lots and lots of websites where you think, oh, I'm accessing this website, you know the name of the website. You don't realize, unless you look a bit, that they're actually being hosted by Cloudflare. They don't have as many end-user-oriented services as, say, Google, but they are a very major player in the web market. They are running, of all the websites that you might be browsing today, a lot of them will be hosted by Cloudflare. And they have this blog post called "Do the Cha-Cha, Better Mobile Performance with Cryptography," where they're thinking about how much time does it take your smartphone to download and decrypt an encrypted web page and then display that to the user. And it turns out that the decryption part of that is a significant cost. Significant enough that they were happy to switch from a completely standard encryption algorithm with many years of approvals and no reason to believe there's any problems with it, called AES-128 GCM, to something non-standard, CHA-CHA 20 Poly-1305. And their sole excuse for that was it's three times faster on your smartphone. Depending exactly which smartphone, maybe it's two times, maybe it's four times. But for their example smartphone, some Samsung, it was three times faster. And they keep advertising this, have a whole blog post about it. They say spending less time on decryption means faster page rendering and better battery life. If you look at the pieces of code that they're talking about here for making a major change to what they're doing to encrypt data, it's very small chunks of code, and that is the chunk of code that's run on all the data that is being downloaded by the smartphone. There's, of course, other things a smartphone is doing, like displaying the data, but this is a significant enough chunk that this tiny piece of code is for them a hotspot, which is motivating them to change what they're doing in their computations. Now, you might think, wait a minute, if they change something to make it faster on mobile, what does that do to their servers? And this is where the story starts getting weird. So let me read this out for you. In order to support over a million HTTPS sites on our servers, we have to make sure CPU usage is low. Sounds like the mobile story so far. To help improve performance on their servers, we're using an open source assembly code version of Cha-Cha Poly by Cloudflare engineer Vlad Krasnov, who actually was at Intel before he moved to Cloudflare, did this with another engineer at Intel and University of Haifa, optimized for our servers' Intel CPUs. This keeps their server-side cost for encrypting to a minimum. Now, here's the weird thing. This was all sounding like a story which I imagine a lot of people here know. Anybody who's doing optimization, you've got this perspective of, yeah, we focus on the performance in these little hotspots. And then I'm talking about web companies and mobile phones. This all sounds nice and modern. What is that assembly code version doing in the middle there? What are engineers doing optimizing code for particular CPUs? It's not just they're making this up. If you actually download the code, which is all available online, then you see chunks of inner loops like this. This is part of a Perl script written by hand, which outputs assembly code after some variable substitution. And I won't go through the details except to point to the first two letters of each line of the assembly there, which are VP, which is Intel's latest vector instructions, doing several integer operations in parallel. Similarly, if you look at the mobile code, there's lots and lots of vector operations, some written with intrinsics in C, some of them written in assembly. And somebody actually wrote these things without using an optimizing compiler to produce the code. So what is going on here? Why would anybody be hand-tuning software for particular machines, writing software in assembly? Okay, it's a Perl script generating some assembly, but basically they're writing code manually in assembly in the 21st century. This is quite different from what you see on, for instance, Wikipedia, which says, by the late 1990s, for even performance-sensitive code, optimizing compilers exceeded the performance of human experts. Now, when I see something like this on Wikipedia, my first thought is, citation needed. My second thought is, wait, this is an area where I know what's actually going on, and the actual human experts who are involved in optimizing things, where things is pretty much any application where anybody cares about performance, the consensus of those experts is that, no, the experts are actually producing much better results than the optimizing compilers are producing. So the advertisement for optimizing compilers that you see on Wikipedia is actually false. And it's even getting more and more false over time. I'll come back to that and explain why. Now, if there were just a disagreement between people calling themselves experts and Wikipedia, then how would you know who's correct? And maybe those experts aren't actually experts. But there is, in the end, a computer running software which is faster, and that's software which is written by these experts, and there's nothing competitive from the optimizing compilers. So something strange is going on here. Apparently, what's in Wikipedia is incorrect. I'm sorry to have to report this to people who trust Wikipedia. It turns out, in what I've seen on Wikipedia, everything's correct except the stuff that I know about. So 99% of Wikipedia is just fine. Example of one of these experts contradicting Wikipedia and proving it with some actual software, which lots of people use, author of the Lua Just-in-Time compiler, in 2011 wrote, and certainly hasn't retracted this, if you write an interpreter loop in assembly, then you can do much better, and he explains all the reasons that compilers have trouble with the kind of code that he's talking about, and says within that domain, there's just no way you can reasonably expect even the most advanced C compilers to do this on your behalf. You might think, well, okay, wait, we need a better language than C, more annotations, et cetera, et cetera. But nobody's been able to produce a combination of language and optimizing compiler, which is, in fact, competitive in this application. In the same recent discussion that I mentioned, triggered by my blogging, my abstract, there was a comment from a compiler fan saying, we come so close to optimal on most architectures that we can't do much more without using NP-complete algorithms instead of heuristics. We can only try to get little niggles here and there where the heuristics get slightly wrong answers. Which sounds good, except the examples keep contradicting this. So somebody followed up saying, okay, let's look at OpenBLAS. I'll come back to this example later. What compiler can take reasonable code for these basic linear algebra subroutines and turn them into compiled code that runs as fast as OpenBLAS, which is the speed record code, which is what people actually use? Inquiring high-performance computing minds want to know. And there's a parenthetical comment saying other common hotspots are available. Well, okay, again, it sounds like a dispute between somebody saying the pattern is optimizing compilers are producing wonderful results versus somebody saying no, 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 but the person saying no, no, no is giving examples, and there wasn't any response to this. Okay, so there's still a question, what's going on here? Obviously, you would expect that optimizing compilers, after many decades of research, would be producing very good code for basically every architecture that we have. But that doesn't, in fact, seem to be the case. So let me take a step back and look at things from the perspective of the algorithm designer. What does the algorithm designer want to do? Well, before you start saying, oh, there's an algorithm, we want to optimize that algorithm, you have to think of what your target is, what metric you're trying to optimize. In introductory computer science courses, we say we want the best time. Who here knows what time means? I don't see any hand. Oh, wait, I see. Okay, what is it? Yeah, okay, I see. money. Yes, money's a very good answer. Yeah, and then the other answer was holding up a phone. And yes, you can define time in terms of a physical device. I'll come back to that. But that's something which isn't really a mathematical specification suitable for analysis, never mind optimization. If you actually want to analyze things, then you need to understand, maybe you don't need a complete definition, but at least you need enough features of the definition to be able to reasonably optimize your algorithms. Of course, if you have some massive speed up where it'll apply in any metric that anybody thinks of, then wonderful, it's clearly good. But most algorithm speed ups aren't like that. Algorithm designers, look, there's lots and lots of algorithms papers every year in all sorts of areas. And some of them are like, wow, we made things much, much, much faster. But most of the papers, for algorithms that, for applications that people care about, you get, say, a factor of 1.3 speed up, and you're happy with that. Or you get, for people who do asymptotics, a log n speed up, and you're happy with that. Occasionally you get some exponent improvement, and then you're happy with that. But most of the speed ups are small. And okay, that's how algorithms make progress most of the time. And if you want to see a small speed up, you need your machine model specified closely enough that you can actually detect those small speed ups in your model, which often gets people in a lot of trouble if they don't pay attention to the definitions. Most people, if you try to define what does time mean in a way that's consistent with the definition of time that we show to computer science students in basic courses, even through fairly advanced algorithms courses, then you end up typically defining what's called a RAM model of computation, a random access machine model of computation, and all of the simplest definitions of this model, they are fast enough to allow the notion of time. It says, yes, this algorithm runs in less than or equal to what you said, but they also have these pathologies where you can optimize algorithms to run much, much faster than anything realistic. So fast, these are not polynomially simulatable by a Turing machine. So the notion of polynomial time for the usual definition of RAM, the simple definition of RAM that everybody writes down, is not strong enough. It's not something where polynomial time in this model means what people think polynomial time should mean. So even the concept of polynomial isn't correct, never mind the exponents, never mind more detailed algorithm optimization. If you put quite a bit more work into it, then you can write down a RAM model where you're careful about the sizes of all of your registers, the sizes of your data that you store in memory. The issue here is that when you're trying to say, what does it mean to say x bracket I equals j, then you have to store j in x bracket I. And, well, then I and j, these indices, need to fit in the same locations where you're storing data. So the X array is obviously not consisting of bits. Otherwise, you have to really complicate how your algorithm designer is writing their algorithms. But then if you allow variable sizes for what you store in X bracket I, then you can start cheating on what your arithmetic is able to do. And you do crazy things like factor integers very, very quickly. And then you have to start limiting how big your array elements can be, but then to avoid breaking your algorithms, you have to have that limit be varying depending on how your algorithm is defined, have an algorithm-specific definition of the model. It can be done. It has been done. It just gets very complicated. Okay, once that's done, then you move on to other metrics that people care about, like space or communication metrics, like how much cache access do you have? You declare some of your memory to be cache and then ask how many times did you have to copy data back and forth between that cache and everything else. And okay, you can define these things and analyze these things. And again, depending how much of an algorithm speed up you want, you have to define this in more detail or you can be more vague about it. Instead of trying to define this, you can, as was suggested, hold up a physical machine. Well, if it's a small one, like a smartphone, and then you get all sorts of obvious physical metrics for that machine. There is a physical notion of time, which, okay, is also a little tricky to define, but at least we can measure it reliably enough that if you're not writing physics papers about the speed of light, then everybody will believe your measurements. And similarly, for larger machines, which you can't quite hold up, maybe you're optimizing your algorithms for your local supercomputer, or maybe you're optimizing for Amazon's data centers, or maybe you're optimizing for the internet. There are some programs which have run on significant chunks of the internet. And if you want to optimize those programs, then you can measure what the results are just by trying out the program and seeing how fast it is, which maybe gives you enough data to analyze, or maybe you want to model what's going on, but at least that's a metric which you can reasonably try to target. Or you can try to say, well, without worrying about the details of these physical machines, let's try to have some mathematical definition, which we can optimize for, which has the features we need. For instance, if you want to do computational complexity theory, then you simplify the definition from a RAM down to a one-tape or multi-tape Turing machine. If you want to have more parallelism, which is important for running code on the internet or a data center or a cluster or, in fact, even on your smartphone, there's parallelism in there. Then you might define a PRAM, parallel RAM, model of computation. All right, so this is the context. The algorithm designer says, I'd like to optimize some algorithm for this particular metric. And once you have a good enough idea what the metric is, then you produce an algorithm. That's the output of the algorithm designer, is an algorithm for whatever problem. So this algorithm is typically an executable algorithm. It's specifying instructions that some machine can follow, the machine used in the definition of the cost metric. And then you want, as the algorithm designer, to do as well as you can in that metric. Of course, the input for the algorithm designer is a function to be computed, which most of the time is also an algorithm. Where the only difference between the input and the output is the input wasn't optimized. So typically, an algorithm designer is taking as input a formula or something else which specifies the function to be computed. The best way to formally specify that tends to be an algorithm in some language, which is not going to be the optimized algorithm that the algorithm designer produces. It'll be optimized for simplicity and verifiability typically, and then you of course want to prove equivalence of that input algorithm to the output algorithm. It doesn't have to be an executable algorithm as input, but that's the typical case. I should also say something I'm also ignoring in the algorithm designer's job. There are a few algorithm designers who try to figure out, can something be computed at all? Whereas I've been focusing on the core of algorithm design, which is making things go faster. But there are sometimes when people's notion of fast is just, is this a recursive function or not? And okay, that's a corner of algorithm design which I'm not talking about. I'm just focusing on optimizing things. You typically start with a simple program to do something, and your output as an algorithm designer is a faster program to do the same thing. Typically in a lower level language that lets you express the optimization. I think everybody who's done algorithm design in whatever area will agree it's not an easy topic. Of course, there's tons and tons of new algorithms all the time, some small speed-ups, some bigger speed-ups. If you want to say, what am I doing as an algorithm designer? It is constantly changing. Sometimes there will be an algorithm that gets superseded and you can throw it away, but most of the time it's just getting more and more complicated. If you want to do a good job of algorithm design, you have to know more and more and more. And the job of the algorithm designer is inherently domain specific. It's something where you can't expect as an algorithm designer who doesn't know stuff about the target that you're looking at, doesn't know the other fancy domain specific algorithms people have. You can't expect to do a good job unless you know a whole lot of things about a whole lot of different algorithms. I've listed just a few of a million algorithms, okay, maybe not a million algorithms out there, but there's thousands of important algorithms and probably tens of thousands of less important algorithms that people really have to know about for different areas if they want to have the best results. All right, so that's the algorithm designer's perspective of what algorithm designers do, which sounds just like what an optimizing compiler does, right? I mean, the algorithm designer, if you believe the Church Turing thesis, then as a human, you are doing something that a machine does. You are a machine. And as an algorithm designer, your mapping from input to output is, well, okay, you might not know what program you're running precisely, but you are running a program. And if I believe the Wikipedia definition of an optimizing compiler, this is exactly what an optimizing compiler does. An optimizing compiler is a compiler, you know, translates from source algorithm to target algorithm, that tries to minimize something in some metric. Okay, so that sounds like exactly the job of the algorithm designer. This is not actually what the word optimizing compiler means. Anybody who's actually doing compiler design will say, no, we're not doing algorithm design. That's a different problem. So they'll say, the same Wikipedia page actually says, a compiler will not change an implementation of bubble sort to use merge sort. Actually, that sounds like a pretty good people optimization to do. You should put that into your compiler. I mean, why not do it? And then you do great on some student benchmarks. The students would have no idea why they should learn any other algorithms. I mean, they just write bubble sort code, and it's really, really fast. And then all these fancier algorithms that they try end up running about the same speed or slower. So I mean, this is actually a pretty good job for an optimizing compiler. Why don't you have an optimizing compiler that builds in all the other algorithms out there? Of course, there is some work on trying to do automated algorithm optimization, but that is not what people mean by optimizing compilers. The line that is actually drawn is the following. People doing optimizing compilers say that their job is to understand the machine, the actual hardware that you're going to run on. And anything that's a machine independent optimization, that's the job of those other people, the algorithm designers. So you start with a function specification, and then these other people, the algorithm designers, are going to produce the best algorithm they can. And then the optimizing compiler kicks in and produces code for your smartphone or your desktop machine or whatever the actual machine is. Of course, if an optimizing compiler happens to do some machine-independent optimizations, nobody will complain. But if it's not doing some machine-independent optimizations, then the optimizing compiler designer will always say, no, no, that wasn't our job. The programmer, the algorithm designer, somebody else should have done that. So, why do we put in this stage into producing the final object code? Why do we have, instead of an algorithm designer saying, hey, there's this object machine, this target machine that we're really targeting, why do we factor that process into have an algorithm designer that's composed of, say, the human algorithm designer, followed by the optimizing compiler? I'm sure people have some idea of why this is a good thing to do and why people are constantly doing it, so let me hear some suggestions. This is not a hard question.
Complexity?
Sorry?
Complexity.
Complexity. Complexity of what?
Of the process.
So, okay, you're thinking that the producing the final object code is complicated. Why is it more complicated than producing the source code?
Because the architecture model is much more complicated.
Yeah, so the object language is more complicated than the source language. I like that answer.
There's also too many of them.
And there's too many of them. Okay, so now in a few seconds, you've got my complete list here. There's saving the designer's time. And maybe somebody has another thing I could add to the list. But it's clear that an optimizing compiler is saving time for all the algorithm designers who no longer have to know anything about the machine and no longer have to look at all the different machines. The algorithm designer just produces one machine-independent algorithm, and then the optimizing compiler runs on all these different algorithms that people produce, and time has been saved for all of those different algorithm designers. Of course, if the optimizing compiler were having to spend extra time looking at all those applications, then that would waste all the time that the algorithm designer's been saving. But again, the optimizing compiler is not something which is looking specifically at the jobs that could have been done by the algorithm designer. The optimizing compiler is just a general purpose tool which takes the machine-independent, optimized source code and produces the many different complicated pieces of assembly language or machine language for real computers. Okay, so clearly there's a savings in time. Time for the designers is a physical concept which we all agree on how to measure. Okay, if you haven't measured it, then you should fill out more bureaucratic forms for your university. Remember what one of the comments was before, that this process is producing great results. This process is producing results so close to optimal, you can only get little niggles when it's slightly suboptimal. But the reality is that that is not actually true. I gave you some examples already. I briefly mentioned that actually it's getting farther and farther from true, and I'll explain to you why. The results, what you get out of an optimizing compiler compared to an algorithm designer targeting the machine, those results are getting less and less satisfactory, which seems like research going backwards. I mean, what's actually going on here? Of course, research is getting better. Of course, people are putting more and more work into these optimizing compilers, and all sorts of cool algorithms are going into that and cool ideas for making that work. And we have lots more time to run the optimizing compiler because CPUs are so fast. And lots of CPUs have disappeared. many more have disappeared than new ones showing up. And also, the variation between architectures that the optimizing compilers are targeting is much, much narrower than the variation that used to be there. There are lots of mistakes in CPU design that have simply been eliminated, and we no longer have to target them as a reasonable optimization result. So, okay, there's this trade-off, apparently, from the examples, and I claim this is a broader phenomenon, there's a trade-off between whether you factor your algorithm design for a particular machine through an optimizing compiler versus doing it directly. There's a trade-off between the time that you spend as the algorithm designer and the quality of the results in whatever metric you're targeting. For example, time for your smartphone. Here's what the code base looks like. There is the fastest code. Things like the crypto code I was mentioning before, the OpenBLAS code. These are hot spots in the code where some algorithm designers have not taken this detour through the optimizing compiler. They've said, we're going to produce the fastest code for these applications. And then there's the mediocre code. These are the hot spots that the algorithm designers haven't gotten to yet, because it does take time for the algorithm designers to target all these different applications. The quality of the code, give me just a sec, the quality of the code that the optimizing compilers produce, you shouldn't expect to be as good as the quality of the code coming from somebody who knows all the optimization tricks, somebody who has some domain-specific tools, is putting together the compiler technology and the domain-specific knowledge that an algorithm designer always needs to have. You can't expect that an optimizing compiler, which only has one of those legs, namely the general purpose optimizations, you can't expect the optimizing compiler to compete with an algorithm designer. Question?
Which platform we are talking about? Is it x86? Is it ARM or PowerPC? Because for PowerPC, for example, writing manual code is really, well, mind-blowing task. And I would prefer those register operations to do by compiler, not by me.
Yeah, so I completely understand. So yeah, the comment was that for PowerPC, for example, it's nicer to have a compiler doing something instead of the human doing something. Absolutely, I agree. The time effects that disappeared off the previous slide, those are real effects. It does take time to target some architecture. The architectures that I'm commenting on, certainly I'm including x86, certainly I'm including ARM. PowerPC I don't actually see as being so different from ARM, although it's mostly being killed by ARM, so it fits in this extermination of many targets. It's still used in some game consoles that lots of people have, and it still has like embedded automotive applications, E600, but mostly the PowerPC can be forgotten for most users. Having said that, the same kind of issues that you see on PowerPC, if you've been optimizing for ARM, you should have seen almost all of the same issues. And yeah, it does take time. If you're going to manually write assembly and deal with register allocation, instruction scheduling, that's kind of painful. But if you say, wait a minute, I don't actually have to do that manually, and if you have a significant chunk of code where it would take serious time to do that manually, and you start bringing in tools which understand the domain-specific problem that you have, can take advantage of your algorithm designer's insight, and use modern optimization techniques to produce the assembly, you will get better results than you can get from an optimizing compiler. I still have to explain to you the underlying phenomena that make this happen. But so far, I'm just describing the observed facts on the ground. All right, so there's the really fast code for the hotspots, which comes from algorithm designers, and there's the not-so-fast code for the hotspots, which is from the optimizing compilers. And this would still leave a bunch of room for the optimizing compilers to do useful stuff, except for what I mentioned at the beginning, which is that we actually don't want to optimize most code. It is a bad idea to optimize most code because optimization is a correctness problem, and it will continue to be a correctness problem. Most code is running so infrequently that optimizing it is a bad idea. So what's happening in the middle here, the optimizing compiler's target, is people who care enough about performance. There must be some code which is in a hotspot, so people care about the performance. They shouldn't just turn off the optimizer. But at the same time, they're pressured from the top by these are hotspots where the algorithm designer hasn't had a chance to look at that hotspot yet and do a better job. The ways that the optimizing compilers can escape from this are by, well, denying that this slowest code is what's happening for most code, or by denying that the fastest code, the algorithm designers, are doing better. And you've seen both of those denials in red earlier in those slides. What actually happens because of the pressure from the top and the pressure from the bottom is that the role of the optimizing compiler fades away. There's less and less room for anybody to use an optimizing compiler because at the top, most of your CPU time ends up being spent in hotspots where the algorithm designer has had the time to optimize code for that hotspot. And meanwhile, for almost all the other code, it's just outside hotspots, so you don't turn on optimization because that would compromise correctness. Yeah?
So shouldn't this suggest that Mike Paul, who you quoted earlier, but who is the author of a highly optimized compiler, should find himself out of a job?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So LuaJIT is an example of code where he's writing that code in assembly, but of course the job of that code is to take other code and run it quickly. And it's precisely because that's a hotspot that that attention was warranted. If you're facing a hotspot and you... How do I say this? If you're in the top situation here, of you understand the domain you're looking at, and you want to optimize the code that you're running, which in this case is there's LuaJIT and then the code that it's running inside, then of course, if you can get away with some general purpose techniques that make the code run at an acceptable speed, then you just do that. If you need special purpose techniques which are coming from your domain, then you use those special purpose techniques. And I would say in the case of LuaJIT, it's a combination of both of those. I think if he were to ignore the domain-specific part, which is the optimizing compiler dogma, then he would end up with code that's just not as fast for everything. And then within the compiled code that he's producing, I'm sure he would be the first to agree that if there's code which is not running fast enough from the JIT, then that should be replaced by something that's running faster. Just as at the interpreter level, he replaced a bad result from his C compiler with a good result from writing an assembly.
But that seems to be just to say that we should, when we have code that's too slow, we should write an optimizing compiler for it.
To some extent, yes. So if you take a broad enough view of optimizing compiler to include a domain-specific...
So
LuaJIT, I wouldn't... How do I say this? So I agree with the point you're making about LuaJIT is a tool which is taking code and saying a lot of times this code is not running fast enough, and so we apply this general purpose JIT, which is then making that code run faster. But just as in the wider world where we have some hotspots and then all the rest of the code which should not be optimized, for the hotspots, you need to have domain-specific knowledge to do the best, and for everything else, you really should turn off the optimizer. In the context of a JIT, as computers get faster and faster, you will find that most code should not actually go through the JIT for exactly the same reasons, that CPUs are getting faster and faster and faster, and most code is not in the hotspots. You can delay the inevitable by saying, well, look at applications where we're wasting so much time and handling so much data that anything we can do feels like a good idea. But as CPUs get faster and faster, as the data volume expands and expands, and as the profiles get concentrated on the hotspots, this idea that, well, we should optimize everything becomes useless. Whereas focusing on the hotspots and doing the best we can on those hotspots remains useful.
So in 10 years, Mike will be out of the job.
So I don't think I said at any moment that Mike would be out of a job. I'm not sure what you're arguing with.
I'm saying that optimizing compilers are dead. And that was the title. Mike is the author of an optimizing compiler.
What do we need JITs for if
the fast stuff is written in assembly, and for the slow stuff, we don't care. It's, I mean, it's a Python, we don't need JIT because we don't care about how fast it is.
Yeah, so I totally understand where you're coming from, and it's exactly the same as the argument that you would make, say, 30 years ago about software, typical software, which is not having its costs magnified by being run through an interpreter. And the same reason that people 30 years ago would have rejected something like Python is exactly the reason that now you're saying, wait, how could we possibly just run typical code through an interpreter? You're delaying seeing what's happening by taking code and running it through an interpreter. I mean, you're starting with a fairly high-level scripting language and then running it through an interpreter, which is at that level not going to produce wonderful results. It'll produce okay results. And then, okay, he wants to make that run as fast as he can for the interpreter code. But if you look ahead, as CPUs get more and more cycles available for the same cost, you will see exactly the same reasons that it's just fine to run things in Python with no optimization for most code. The same will happen for code running inside interpreters for other languages. And it's only the occasional hotspots that will get more and more concentrated. Everything I'm describing is just getting more and more magnified as time goes by. It's only for those occasional hotspots that people will care about optimization. So I'm drawing an analogy to what it would have been like with Python 30 years ago. Imagine how inconceivable it would be for somebody to say, yeah, we'll have this interpreter and we won't even bother with optimizing stuff, except if you actually care, then you take special effort to optimize. That would have sounded crazy 30 years ago. And now in the situation of Lua, you're making the same argument now. And I totally understand where you're coming from. And I would have said the same thing about Python 30 years
ago. So you are saying that in the future we won't need things like LuaJIT because CPUs will be fast enough that the only thing we care about will be the hotspot which someone will have written in assembler.
Yes.
A domain-specific tool that takes a high-level specification and produces fast assembler.
Yes.
Which we may or may not call an optimizing compiler.
Well, if you... Sure, if you say that the optimizing compiler is allowed to be the algorithm designer and look at all the domain-specific input, then optimizing compilers are not dead. Algorithm design is not dead. However, optimizing compilers, as everybody actually uses the word, that concept is dead. All right, so your question here.
On the very first example you gave for the startup, is it really domain-specific algorithm design, or is it more, I take an already generative code and I'm doing fine-tuning code optimization for the target machine. So is it really algorithm design or is it homemade smart code optimization?
So you mean in the crypto example. So I'm not sure what distinction you're drawing. Wrong keyboard. Let me try rewinding back to that example. Yeah, this example here. So
is it really algorithm design? That means you know that you're doing cryptographic, you change the algorithm to go to this one, or you look at the assembly code generated by an unoptimizing compiler, you see that you're not happy with it, so you, with respect to the machine, you look at the code, and you don't do algorithm design, you do code optimization.
Okay, the difference So the difference is that an algorithm designer is looking at the domain-specific inputs. The optimizing compiler is not. In this particular case, I happen to have designed the algorithm for vector machines some years before vector machines were as common as they were today. So I can authoritatively say for this particular case that the answer, I didn't write this particular code, but in this particular case, the encryption algorithm and the decryption algorithm, these were designed thinking about what the actual machine was. And that was successful, as you can see from Cloudflare's deployment.
Okay, so it's the hotspot of the algorithm, not the hotspot of the program.
Well, the hotspot of the system,
yes.
Let's say the internet. In this case, there's a significant chunk of it where people have their smartphones downloading encrypted data. They have to decrypt it. And this is a significant enough chunk of code that the time they were spending inside AES, that was actually a significant bottleneck for all these smartphones contacting Cloudflare sites. And again, both on the client side and on the server side, they're worried about the performance of that. So they're actually willing to put in the time. I saw another hand back there.
I'm worried that unskilled programmers will write code with hotspots.
I think the reality is that most code that most people run is from serious programmers and not from the students that you're thinking of.
I have a topic. In my institute, a biologist who run their simulation for months.
Yeah.
And they're writing in Python.
Yeah. So. Yeah, it's an interesting example. So,
who are serious programmers, and they are unskilled in your sense.
Yeah, I completely understand what you're saying. I've been quite unimpressed with the code quality that I've seen in a lot of high-performance computing applications. And I don't know if this one was a supercomputing-type application or just on their local machines. I think both for code correctness and for performance, these things can often be massively improved. Fortunately, it turns out that in these applications, there are some core subroutines which are useful for most of these people. So the typical, say, physics simulation is doing a lot of the basic linear algebra subroutines, a lot of FFTs. Depends on the type of physics that you're simulating. I don't know enough about biological computations to comment on that. But as these typical areas of computation become the targets of algorithm designers, they end up with algorithms that really are optimized for the target machine. And then if the scripting stuff around that is written in Python, that's just fine. Okay, I'm being warned that I have half an hour left, and I promised that I would explain to you what's actually going on under the hood. Okay. Just before that explanation, I had an example of those of you who are doing compilers and don't like the message that I'm giving. This is what you should be doing. This is an example. So OpenBLAS, as I mentioned, this is one of these core subroutines used in lots and lots of computations. And the fastest code out there, there's some hand-optimized code from Intel, a library called MKL, something similar from AMD. There's Atlas, which, as this OpenBLAS paper mentions, says many of the kernels in Atlas are manually implemented in assembly by domain experts. Even the ones which don't have somebody actually writing assembly instructions have a lot of domain expert knowledge going into that. And then they talk about how they can unify the domain-specific concerns with the compiler techniques. It's not throwing away all the concepts of compiler research. It's having an extra input of the human who actually understands something about the application and building domain-specific compilers. And if you'd like to call these optimizing compilers, go ahead. And once you allow the domain-specific part of that, then this is what I expect to persist into the future, because this is how OpenBLAS was produced. And this is what you see happening in one domain after another. So why are the optimizing compilers not doing what we expect them to do, what they've been saying for decades that they're doing? Why are the experts able to beat the optimizing compilers? Why is there such a gap between the performance of the object code that's produced from source code, which should be not that different, versus what a domain expert produces? The basic reason for that is that CPUs are getting farther and farther away from what the source language says the target is. The source language has some built-in ideas of here's what kind of computations we are doing. And the actual CPU is doing something very, very different. There's a few of these things where anybody doing compilers or just general paying attention to what CPUs advertise, you will have heard about pipelining, superscalar stuff. This is something that compilers can typically deal with in an easily automatable way. However, it's getting a lot worse. Vectorization is kind of the cusp. This is what's convincing a lot of people that optimizing compilers cannot be trusted to produce good code. And then it gets worse beyond that. I'll give one final example, which is the mesh. In general, communicating to memory is a huge issue for tons and tons of software. So what is a CPU designer thinking? Why are CPUs evolving? Well, the CPU designer is making reasonable decisions from the platform they're starting with to provide performance to all the applications they care about, which is all the applications we care about. At a very, very low level, they're starting with say, NAND gates. If you know a little more about circuitry, you can optimize things a bit more. But this is a picture of a not so untypical computation, not so atypical, which is multiplying integers. Okay, they're a bit small, two-bit integers, F0 plus 2F1 and G0 plus 2G1. And if you trace through the NAND gates here, so each of the little ANDs with a bar on top, that is taking the two bits of input and multiplying them and complementing the result. So it takes A and B, maps to 1 minus AB. If you look at the F0 and G0, for instance, computes 1 minus F0, G0, and then that input gets copied into the NAND gate below it, which turns that NAND into just an inverter. So you end up with, down at the bottom, H0 is F0 times G0, which is what integer multiplication mod 2 should be. And then it's a little more work to verify the other bits of output. I'll leave as an exercise for you to try to do better than this. Okay, I'm not going to show you more of these pictures, just that's the starting point. Zooming out to some bigger ones, let me first comment that these NAND gates are actual physical objects. This is something where electricity is being sent through wires and gets into a gate, and then electricity comes in from the other side. And once those electrical signals are stable, somebody's holding these bits high at once, then the NAND gate produces its result a moment later. It takes something on the scale of a picosecond for one of these gates to stabilize its output. Okay, if you have F0, G0, G1, F1 held high or low for 1 or 0 bits, then after some number of picoseconds, the H's will also be stable at high or low for 1 bits or 0 bits. Okay, bigger multiplier, no details, but here's a multiplier for 32-bit integers. You can fill in the details for yourself. And this is the kind of thing that happens in a starting hardware design course. Another conceptually maybe slightly more complicated thing, although it's a simpler circuit to optimize, is reading from a register file. So a register file, imagine that you have 16 32-bit integers, R0, R1 through R15, where each of those has 32 bits. And you're given an index, which is 4 bits, specifying one of those positions, the I specifying R sub I. Then you can work out a circuit which, by composing NAND gates, eventually produces at the bottom R sub I, given the R's and I as input. Okay, and that's called a register read circuit. Similarly, you can do a register write. So this is something which takes a list R0 through R15, takes an index, takes a new replacement value, and overwrites one of those R's with the that new value. So R0 and R15 turn into R0 prime through R15 prime, where all of the R primes are equal to the original R's except for the one that you said should be modified. So we've got some mutable state here, although I've expressed it functionally. Similarly, you build addition circuits, subtraction circuits. I'm not going to go through any more of the low-level details. Once you have these chunks of circuitry, then you can put them together to start building a CPU. Well, this is still maybe a little too simple to be recognizable as a CPU, but if you compose the register read of reading register J and a register read reading register K from the same R0 through R15 with the wires all hooked up appropriately, and then you feed those into the 32-bit multiplier, and then you feed the R's and the multiplier result into the register write to overwrite register I, then at the end of the day you get 16 new registers where the only difference from the originals is that Ri prime is Rj times Rk. And that's starting to sound a little bit like following a multiplication instruction, and with just a little more flexibility, we do get something that is a reasonable CPU. Some essentials that you have to do: you don't just want to multiply, it's not that interesting and operate. Well, okay, it's one of the most important things that CPUs are doing, but you need a few more to make the CPU actually useful for people. GPUs can do multiplication and addition and subtraction and more. So you add some more options. Instead of your instructions just being IJK, you have some operations, say O and IJK, where the operation might be a multiply or an addition or something similar. And then later in the circuit, you have to have a multiplier and an adder and a subtractor and everything else that you're interested in, with some way to compute, given the operation, which of those circuits you should activate and take its result. Instruction fetch. So you want to read the instructions you're going to follow from somewhere. Instead of just having IJK as fixed inputs, you take the IJK themselves from some array, and also that operation O. So you have some pointer P into an array of instructions, and then you read from position P in the operation array and the operand specifier array ijk, you also figure out a new instruction pointer, p prime, which is typically something like p plus 1. And then, well, CPU designers, they're really responsible for most of the performance that we get, and they care about optimizing everything, so they try to compress the representation of the oijk and p prime. And there's some instruction decode, which is computing the uncompression. It's decompressing the oijk p prime. And then there's some more operations. I'll mention just one of those important operations, which is talking to RAM, because you should appreciate that this is something slower than talking to registers. Just having wires that are locally doing operations is much faster than talking to some faraway larger part of memory. The fact that memory is larger implies that it's farther away. I'll come back to the communication costs later. All right, without worrying about RAM, once we put these chunks together, we almost have a CPU. You just need something non-functional, which is called a flip-flop. So what a flip-flop is a little chunk of circuitry that holds a bit of data. And it has an output line, and it holds that output line high or low, sends electrical 1 or 0 through that output. And it also has an input, so it can change. This input is going to be something that will overwrite the bit that it's storing. And then it also has a clock signal coming in. And whenever the clock signal pulses, then the flip-flop throws away the bit that it has and takes the input and then starts holding the line high or low according to its new stored bit. So that's a flip-flop. And then you hook the instructions that I've described, the circuitry I've described, to some flip-flops which are storing the bits of the Rs and also that P, the instruction pointer. And then you also take the outputs of the register write and you hook those back into the same flip-flops. And then you feed in a clock, which pulses and says, OK, replace your R0 through R15 state with the R0 prime through R15 clock. So there's the mutability of the state. Obviously, the clock ticks have to be spaced far enough that there's enough picoseconds for the electricity to get through all of the gates and all the wires and stabilize back to the flip-flops at the top of the circuit. And assuming that you do that, assuming you schedule your clock correctly, then you have a functioning CPU, which can actually start doing some interesting stuff. And it looks something like this. You have the flip-flops at the top feeding into the instruction fetch, feeding into the instruction decode, feeding into reading to registers, and then multiplexing between addition, subtraction, and multiplication. I've shown these as the same size box. Obviously, the addition is a much narrower circuit than the multiplication is. And then register write hooked back into the flip-flops at the top. And, okay, this is all you need to know about what a CPU physically looks like to understand all the optimizations that CPU designers do. For instance, pipelining. Now, this is a trick to speed up the clock, maybe by as much as a factor of 5. If you balance the stages in your pipeline, put the flip-flops the same number of picoseconds away from each other, then you can speed up the clock so that there's just enough time for the flip-flops at the top to percolate data through to the next stage of flip-flops, and then you can pulse the clock again. So the idea of this pipelining, the semantics of the pipelining, are that this is time-based semantics. Sorry for those of you who are trying to formalize this, but this is an actual physical object which I'll talk about. What you do is each instruction is going to follow its way through the pipeline, typically on one cycle. People say cycle for the time from one tick to the next, although things are no longer cycling all the way through in one cycle. From one tick of the clock to the next, an instruction will go through instruction fetch. And then through the next cycle to the next tick, it'll go through the instruction decode and be stored in these flip-flops. And then the next tick, it'll go through reading the registers. And then the next tick, it'll go through some arithmetic. And then the next tick, it'll go through the register write, which feeds back into the flip-flops at the top. Now, you have to be careful to do this correctly. For instance, the P prime coming out of the instruction fetch, the location of the new instruction, that doesn't wend its way through the whole chain. That has to immediately come into the flip-flops at the top, which are storing the P for where do we get the next instruction from on the next cycle. And there's other things you have to watch out for correctness. For instance, suppose you have an instruction which is reading some inputs, multiplying, writing the outputs. That'll actually take 3 cycles to get through the read, multiply, write. But suppose that one cycle later, there's an instruction trying to read the result. then there has to be a little extra circuitry which is recognizing that, wait a minute, we have to stop and stall and not do that subsequent instruction because it's reading a result that it doesn't actually have at the time that it'll get to the register read. It has to wait for one or two cycles depending how fast you can forward data from the write to the read. In the picture that I've drawn, it would be waiting for 5 cycles. Okay, so pipelining can make your clock go something like 5 times faster, requires more attention, it does take some work for the CPU designer, it does have a little bit of extra area for the flip-flops and a little bit of extra area for the extra control to make sure that your semantics are preserved. Similarly, from first principles, just knowing that you're trying to do computations from these gates and wires and flip-flops hooked together, an obvious thing to do is what's called superscalar processing. Now, I don't have text explaining this, but it should be obvious to you from the picture what this is doing. So just, I mean, most people, I imagine, have heard of superscalar stuff, but somebody who hasn't heard of superscalar before, I hope can look at this and say, oh, I see what it's doing. Oh, I guess everybody's heard of superscalar before. Yeah, I see lots of nods. So superscalar means you can run multiple instructions at once. So what's happened here is basically every chunk of the circuit has been doubled except the arithmetic in the middle. The two instruction fetches try to fetch P and P plus 1. Well, what if P plus 1 is not P prime? Have to work out the confusion there, but so there's a little extra effort. But presuming that they fetch two instructions successfully, then they decode both instructions, then read all the relevant registers, then, well, now there's trouble. If both instructions want to multiply, then one of them's going to have to wait till the next cycle. And so again, there's a bit of work and a bit of circuitry to recognize that situation and prevent it from happening. But assuming that in every cycle there's an addition and a subtraction, or an addition and a multiply, or a multiply and a subtract, then two instructions happen with a circuit that's actually significantly less than twice as big. Of course, you could have separate cores and use the same circuit area for two complete copies of the original pipeline. But this gets most of the same benefit in less circuit area. And it's an overall improvement in the price-performance ratio. Very similarly, from just seeing these pictures and thinking as a chip designer, what do I want to do? How can I do the most computation per gate, the most computation per area of my chip, given the clock frequency that I'm running at? Obvious thing to do is vectorization. What a vector unit, a vector chip does, is instead of working with 32-bit integers, it'll work with, say, a pair of 32-bit integers and just do separate additions on each component of that of those vectors, separate multiplications on each component of those vectors. Or it's not just pairs. Like a little smartphone has four-way vectorization, 128-bit vectors with four 32-bit pieces. And that's how you do arithmetic quickly on a smartphone. On a big Intel chip these days, if you get the very latest, fanciest Intel supercomputing chips, you can get 512-bit vectors. Mass market machines, most of the machines in this room would have 256-bit vectors. Graphics cards have much larger vectors. And when people are doing GPU programming, then this is a huge issue. How do they take advantage of these vectors? And from the chip designer's perspective, what does it mean in that previous picture to do vectors? Well, the instruction fetch doesn't change. The instruction decode doesn't change. The register read now has to read 4, 8, 16 times as much data. The register write has to write more data. The addition, multiply, subtract have to write n times as much data. So from the chip designer's perspective, if they make the arithmetic circuits n times bigger, the read and write circuits n times bigger, use n times as much area for part of the circuit, then they will get n times as much arithmetic done. The same instructions will be applied to n times as much data in the same cycle speed with less than n times as big a circuit because the instruction part hasn't gotten bigger. So the instruction costs are maybe not eliminated, but made much smaller compared to the performance you're getting out of this chip. Of course, for the algorithm designer, this is an interesting challenge. This is something where it started with programmers doing low-level vectorization and, to some extent, optimizing compilers starting to tackle this problem. But then it's percolated up into very high levels of algorithm design where each stage starts realizing, wait a minute, the performance model I had for lower-level subroutines is no longer correct. I can get a factor of 4, 8, 16 improvement, or on GPUs even more, if I think about vectorization. And so higher level algorithm designs have been redone, sometimes completely throwing away the original structure, which is what happened in that crypto example, in order to be vectorizable. Sometimes in physics kinds of simulations, you'll throw away accuracy, use completely different algorithms in order to get vectorization. Because, hey, a 4 times, 8 times, 16 times speedup, that is more than you get out of most algorithms papers. It is a worthwhile thing to do, even if you only get 3 times, 5 times speedup. Okay, that's vectorization. I still have 10 minutes, and I wanted to show you one last example. I said CPUs are evolving. It means it's not done yet. There's one horrifying thing for the optimizing compilers, which I guarantee you, if you're a compiler designer, you will give up after this example. On the other hand, if you say it's a happy world of cooperating with the algorithm designer and understanding what the chip is about, then some progress can be made. Sorting. I've chosen a simple algorithm example here because I expect people have heard of it before. How long does it take to sort n numbers?
Linear.
All right, so I've heard order of n. Let's not quibble about log factors and stuff and exactly which kinds of RAM models you're assuming. Sorry?
How big are the integers?
Yeah, that's also an important question. So I've specified on the slide here that the n integers are between 1 and n squared. So you're not going to spend forever looking at each integer. And the linear, it's mainly a question of how many integers you have, not how big each integer is. Okay, you know what sorting is supposed to do. Let me specify the machine model, because remember, as an algorithm designer, you have to know what your metric is supposed to be. I'm writing seconds here because I want to emphasize I'm talking about some physical notion of time, which is maybe slightly conflicting with my use of the little O of 1 on the next line, because physicists will tell you that the universe can only do big O of 1 computation that you can see because of the holographic principle, blah, blah, blah. Ignoring that and saying there is an intermediate model of physics, say Newtonian physics, which still allows circuits and allows you to asymptotically have n go to infinity, I don't want to get caught up in log factors and big O's. I just want to look at the exponent of n. Obviously, if the target is a circuit, to do sorting n numbers, you're going to need n times something space in the circuit. The area for the circuit has to be n units of, well, n bits of storage plus some computation. If you want those bits to be kind of close together, then it's convenient to assume n is a square. For some recursive algorithms, it's convenient to assume n is a power of 2. So let me just assume n is a power of 4 for simplicity. And now I heard a vote for linear speed to sort. But how do you actually sort in linear time? What algorithm do you have in mind which on an actual circuit of size n is going to sort in linear time?
Radix sort.
Yeah, radix sort is the sort of thing we teach students and say, yeah, in the following oversimplified machine model, this takes linear time, which is great as long as you fit inside cache. But n does not fit inside cache. So what happens when you're sorting gigabytes of data, terabytes of data? Then this whole notion that you can randomly access data very quickly breaks down. If you try to build a circuit of size n that allows you to access data all the way over here in RAM somewhere, it actually takes a long time to get data over there. Even if you really optimize the computation of R sub I, where R is now your entire RAM, you can't actually do that as quickly as a whole lot of little computations on data. When you look at the performance of radix sort, it's totally untrue that your time is dominated by, well, these computations where you pick something up really quickly and then think about which list should it go on to, put it there, etc. No, all of your time is spent accessing memory on a real physical circuit. And if you implement radix sort in a reasonable way, then you will end up taking time n to the 1.5. However, you can do better. Because in lots of algorithms, including certain versions of radix sort, you can pipeline enough that the data far away that you need, you can send a bunch of pieces of send a bunch of memory accesses after each other down a single bus, have the results come back to you all pipelined, and then reduce the n to the 1.5 down to n with a sufficiently fancy algorithm. Of course, if you had a machine model which only allowed you to do N to the 1.5 sorting, then you would say that's a bad machine model because we can actually do N with enough work on the structure of the machine, which requires a very fancy memory and a carefully done algorithm. And similarly, these algorithms, which take linear time, and the whole notion that sorting takes linear time, is something that you should throw away once you understand that a circuit of this size can sort in time N to the 0.5. The notion that you should be optimizing for a RAM model of computation is about as dumb as the notion that you should be optimizing for a Turing machine. A single-tape Turing machine, the exponents are just wrong. Sorting takes time N squared on a one-tape Turing machine. Sorting takes time N if you don't appropriately adapt your computation to the machine. So let me show you this square root of N times sorting algorithm. You have to, first of all, arrange your machine in a square root of N by square root of N array of parallel processors. Imagine a GPU with lots and lots of separate processors, but they also need links to the adjacent processors, which GPUs don't have. I'll come back to that. Assume that you sensibly arrange your circuit like this, lots of separate cores attached to their neighbors. Then let's use this to sort, first of all, just one row of data in time square root of N. I've taken some random numbers out of my computer, 31415926, and sorted adjacent pairs, which is something you can do in parallel. In just one compare exchange step, and at the same time, one compare exchange step for all the subsequent positions, you can sort the 1 and 3, sort the 1 and 4, sort the 5 and 9, sort the 2 and 6. And then, that was the even-numbered positions, even-numbered indices. Then you do the same on the odd-numbered indices. This is called odd-even sort. And then you keep going square root of n times, and that will sort an array of square root of n numbers in time square root of n, well, square root of n compare exchange steps. Can easily prove that that works. And this is also something that you can do for every row. You split your n numbers into square root of n rows, and you can sort every row in parallel in time square root of n. All right, what about sorting the whole array? Well, here's an algorithm called Shimler sort. You take the quadrants of your array, the top left, top right, bottom left, bottom right. You sort each of those recursively, assuming n is bigger than 1. If n is 1, then you bottom out the recursion. And then, well, also if n is bigger than 1, you do some operations on columns and rows, four more steps. So you sort every column, sort every row, sort every column, sort every row, and then the whole array is sorted. You just stop there. Assuming that you make the right decisions about left to right and right to left, which I'll show you on the subsequent slides, then this can be easily proven to sort everything. So here's again some more random numbers from my computer. I will expect you to follow along the sorting process as we sort the quadrants. If I took, for instance, the bottom left quadrant, then looking around you can see two zeros and two ones. The bottom left I'm sorting from right to left, and the bottom right I'm sorting from right to left. And the top, I'm sorting from left to right within each quadrant. And you can check that, yeah, there are four nines in the top right quadrant. Yep, there's a 9, 9, 9, 9. You can spot check that this was done correctly. Okay, that's the first step of sorting the whole array. And then you sort every column. And again, I'll expect you to check that this has been done correctly. All the columns are being sorted top to bottom. Okay, sort each row. I'll give you a moment to spot check there that, yeah, there's the right number of threes on the fourth row. Okay, you can go back to my slides online and see that this all works. I should emphasize the direction of sorting here, as you can see if you've tried to check, is the first row left to right, the second row right to left, next third row left to right, etc. And then you sort the columns. And then you sort the rows, now all from left to right, and you're done. Okay, maybe it's not completely obvious why this works, but you can prove that this works. And this takes time square root of n. The total time to sort an array of size n is square root of n. Chips are evolving towards having this structure. People talk about network on chip. This is the mesh. This is the Omni mesh from Intel. This is what current Intel supercomputing chips have done, and it is, in a provable sense, the ultimate network, so they're not going to have that evolve further. Other chips are still moving in this direction. So GPUs, as I mentioned, don't have such nearest neighbor communication. They can't efficiently simulate this fast sorting. GPUs take much more time to sort. But current Xeon Phi chips will sort in square root of n time. They will sort n numbers in square root of time, square root of n time, on a chip of size n. If you don't pay attention to the machine, if you don't understand the machine's capable of this, and design your sorting algorithm to exploit the machine, never mind vectorization and all those smaller effects that I mentioned before, you will not get the right exponent for sorting. You must pay attention to the machine and to the algorithm to come up with an algorithm like this. If you try doing any other algorithm, then you'll find that it runs much, much slower, even on this architecture. Yeah?
Can you do three dimensions?
You can do three dimensions, yeah. So you can get a cube root of n algorithm. This particular evolution of CPUs is something which has been having all sorts of ramifications for high-level algorithm design in lots and lots of areas. People have realized that this is happening to CPUs. This has happened to some extent to GPUs. It is the direction that chips are going. And if you want your algorithms to run fast, you must pay attention to this. Here's a very domain-specific example. As you heard, I started in computational number theory. If you want to factor integers very efficiently, you use the number field sieve. The bottleneck in the number field sieve is something called sieving. And that, on a realistic machine architecture, should be replaced by a completely different algorithm, the elliptic curve method, which is it's not something your optimizing compiler will come up with. All right. I had a few slides with some final quotes to finish this
and
off.
Zero time
for the quotes. Time is money. Okay, how much do you need? Okay. So the quick summary, for those of you who are doing optimizing compilers, I'm not saying throw away the work. Of course, everything you do with an optimizing compiler is a valuable thing. But you need more inputs. You need to work with the domain experts. You need the algorithm design and the architecture to talk to each other. And if you want to stay relevant, you have to be the interface between them. For those of you who are interested, there's quotes which are suggesting exactly that from exactly the same Knuth article in 1974. There's been just a little bit of progress in the 40 years since then, and I hope to see a whole lot more. Thanks for your attention.